Epilogue. The Nightmare and the Dream. The June 1943 issue of the now extinct journal, The Nervous Child, carried a paper titled Autistic Disturbances of Affective Contact. The first 24 pages told about 11 children who had in common a pattern of behavior not previously considered in its startling uniqueness. 28 years have elapsed since then. The patients were between 2 and 8 years old when first seen at the Children's Psychiatric Clinic of the Johns Hopkins Hospital. What has become of them? What is their present status? Leo Kanner. Follow-up study of 11 autistic children, originally reported in 1943. Published in 1971. Estimates vary. But the number of Americans today who have an autism spectrum diagnosis, primarily autism, Asperger's, or pervasive development disorder, not otherwise specified, PDD-NOS, is in the hundreds of thousands, the vast majority under the age of 18. At least 40,000 children born this year, and the next, if nothing changes, will receive the diagnosis. What will become of them? Here, we glimpse that future by updating the 7 cases and families in Leo Kanner's original case series that we were able to identify. Each case begins with an excerpt from Kanner's 1971 follow-up. John Trivette, Herbert B., Case 7. After a short stay at the Emma Pendleton Bradley home in Rhode Island and another at Twin Maples, a school of adjustment for the problem child, in Baltimore, he was placed, by his mother, with Mr. and Mrs. Moreland, who had a farm in Maryland. He seemed happy there from the beginning. He followed the farmer around on his chores and helped him making things in the barn. Moreland reported in October 1950. He knows his way around and can go for miles and come back without getting lost. He learned to cut wood, uses the power mower, rakes the lawn, sets the table perfectly, and in his spare time works jigsaw puzzles. Occasionally he gets upset if there is a sudden change in plans. When his mother comes to visit, he gets himself absorbed and does not come toward her. After Mr. Moreland's death, the widow opened a nursing home for elderly people. Herbert remained with her, took the old ladies out for walks, brought their trays to their rooms, but never talked. Herbert is now 33 years. His father wrote on January 5, 1971, "He is with the people in Maryland. It is several years since I have seen him, but I'll take your word that he is essentially unchanged." More than anything else, he seemed to enjoy doing jigsaw puzzles, which he can do with the utmost skill. Two men sit at opposite ends of a dining room table of a ranch house in rural Maryland. One of them wears a large napkin as a bib. Across from him sits another man, older, finishing his soup. In comparison to the younger man, this man does not look impaired at all. He wears a pink polo shirt and wire-frame glasses. He could be a retired English professor. This is John Trivette, a resident in this small, well-kept, cheerful group home with 3 other men. We meet the woman who tends the house and looks after the men. Yes, she does know that he was one of the original cases. "John is no trouble," she says, as he scoops the remains of his soup and sandwich into the wastebasket. Occasionally he will do something odd. Watering the houseplants one day, he just kept watering and watering one plant until it overflowed. And then he kept on watering. She got after him, she said in the tone of a benevolent but no-nonsense mother, and he didn't do it anymore. He does not speak, but he understands what is said. He comes outside and poses with us for a picture. He He does not appear to be unhappy or disturbed, but he does not interact, and it is eerie and sad. This, we realize, is what autism looks like at 70, at least for case 7. In 1953, John's mother, pediatrician Elizabeth Peabody, gave up her practice in Annapolis and went to Iraq to launch a Well Baby outreach program for the U.S. Public Health Service. Much like the Harvard Project she had been part of 15 years earlier, she described her mission in 1955 in A Maternal Child Health Service on the Euphrates. In our first year and a half, she wrote, we saw 3,300 babies in 16,600 clinic visits and 2,000 expectant mothers in 8,000 clinic visits. We immunized a large number of the 3,300 infants against diphtheria, whooping cough, tetanus, typhoid fever, and smallpox. In a letter home, she wrote, the abbreviations are hers, the obstetrical cases we get are sometimes fantastic, and though many close calls, we haven't lost a mother in the hospital as yet. The baby clinic is hectic, though we limit ourselves to 1 year and under. We have 50 to 75 daily and are worn out 6 days a week. An increasing no cases for well baby care, and we try to stress the teaching aspects of pediatrics, immunizations and feeding advice. It is only by showing them each step that they can understand, and they have strong superstitions and fancies which will take years to change. When she returned to the States, she joined the Public Health Service in Atlanta as Director of Child Health Services for the Southeast Region, continuing her lifelong commitment to disease prevention and vaccination. But this adventurous and pioneering woman's career was cut short when she developed breast cancer. She died in 1965 at the Public Health Service Hospital in Baltimore. She was 59 years old. It is clear from a letter she wrote Leo Kanner not long before her death that she blamed herself, or at least her marriage, for her children's problems. Besides John, one child, the daughter who in infancy reversed pronouns and engaged in repetitive behaviors before seeming to blossom out after the divorce, was now a single mother to an infant following a disastrous marriage. A second son has cost me $450 monthly as he gets intensive psychiatric treatment. Our marriage, she wrote, seems to have produced 3 emotionally crippled children. Yet she bore it remarkably well. Dr. Helen Taussig, another woman medical pioneer who had helped develop the Blue Baby cardiac surgery at Hopkins, was a good friend who worked with her for 2 years at Hopkins and called her Betty. Her life was not easy, Taussig wrote in a tribute upon her death. Many would say that life had not treated her kindly, but for Betty, every obstacle was a challenge to be courageously met and successfully mastered. A year ago, she knew she had cancer. She had the comfort of knowing she had done her best for her children, and it was truly a remarkable best. She wrote me that it was too bad to have to leave her little grandchild so soon, but during the last months, she never talked of death. One day she did say that she thought she had had a good life. Those of us who knew even some of the many hardships that she faced and the difficulties that she overcame appreciate the gallantry of her own appraisal of her life. Bridget Munsey, Barbara Kay, Case 5. Barbara was placed at the Devereux Schools in the summer of 1942 and remained there until June 1952. When she was admitted to the Springfield State Hospital, Maryland, where she is still residing. She is now 37 years old. A note written by her ward physician October 8, 1970, has this to say. She still has the stereotyped smile, the little girl-like facial expression with a placid grin, the childlike voice when uttering parrot-like repetitions, Whenever I pass the ward, she greets me as follows. Doctor, do you know I socked you once? Then she usually gets very close to the writer, following her to the office. She still shows a total absence of spontaneous sentence production. The same phrases are used over and over again, with the same intonation. Her mind is fixed to the same subjects, which vary to some degree with the person she is communicating with. Besides all of this, she is childish, impulsive, subject to temper outbursts, with stamping her feet, crying loudly, and upsetting other patients. Her memory is completely intact. She likes to hum some melodies monotonously. Whenever she feels like it, she bangs the piano with well-known songs. At another dining room table in Maryland, we sit and talk with Peter Munsey, Bridget's brother, and his wife, Mary Kay. Peter worked at the Baltimore Sun and then spent most of his career as a writer at the World Bank. Peter is gracious, but frank in telling us that he does not see a connection between our theories and Bridget's condition. When we first identified Bridget and got in touch with him, he wrote us this account. If I sounded shocked yesterday, I was. It was like being reintroduced to the 500-pound gorilla lurking out of sight in the room of the mind. After I finished Dr. Kanner's write-up about Barbara Kay, I knew that I had read it before. I don't remember where or under what circumstances, but there were a lot of aha moments in rereading it. It had to have been my father who gave it to me to read. Bridget was shipped off to Devereux when I entered kindergarten. She rarely came home, except at Christmas time, when, as a treat, we would share the same bed. We would chat with each other into the night, anticipating Christmas as siblings would normally do. I remember visiting her at Devereux perhaps once, or at the most twice a year. We would have an outing at a nearby amusement park. Lenape Park, it was called. Bridget and I would ride the Ferris wheel and roller coaster together. For me, if not for my parents, these outings were jolly occasions. Looking back on those times, and on those subsequent years after she was handed off to the Springfield Hospital Center, Devereux demanded a huge lump sum payment, $60,000, I think it was, for lifetime care, a sum my father could not come up with. It seems that my parents were trying to isolate me from her, as if her condition might be contagious. They would not believe that for an instant, but such is my impression. I would see Bridget a couple of times yearly when she was at Springfield. It was a not-too-distant drive from our farm in Harford County, on her birthday and at Christmas. I vividly remember the drives back home in the wintry darkness, my mother weeping continuously. My father silent at the wheel of the car, and me scared and still in the back seat. I really got to know Bridget well only after my father died in 1984. For decades, my father saw Bridget weekly. He was a senior advisor at Springfield Hospital, mentoring and teaching young physicians at the facility. There is a building there that bears his name, the Munsey Center. He would see Bridget after his counseling sessions. After he died, I took up the mantle, seeing Bridget one day each weekend until her death from cancer about 10 years ago. My mother didn't drive. She went with me and my wife on picnics with Bridget, perhaps 4 times a year. Even as Bridget neared the end of her life, her mind virtually gone from years of institutionalization and daily ingestion of powerful pharmaceuticals, her long-term memory was remarkable. A phenomenon observed both by me and my wife, as well as by the nurses at the hospital, who, by the way, were greatly fond of her. She remembered, for instance, the names of most of her kindergarten classmates, and she duplicated that feat in other realms. In my presence, the nurses at the hospital would show off Bridget's savant abilities, asking her questions about names, places, and events in the distant past, about which she almost invariably could recall. These days I visit Bridget once a year, at our family burial plot in Harford County. There I commiserate with her about the shitty hand she was dealt at the time of her birth. Lee Reuven Rosenberg, John F. Case 10. In December 1942 and January 1943, he had two series of predominantly right-sided convulsions, with conjugate deviation of the eyes to the right and transient paresis in the right arm. Neurologic examination showed no abnormalities. His eye grounds were normal. An EEG indicated focal disturbances in the left occipital region. Dr. Hilde Brüch, who saw him in 1953, remarked on his exuberant emotional expression with no depth and variation and with immediate turn-off when the other person withdraws the interest. John died suddenly in 1966 at 29 years of age. Jay Rosenberg is Lee's younger brother. Like his father, he is a neurologist. Seymour Rosenberg was a neurologist psychiatrist in the manner typical of his day. He practices in San Diego. He's cheerful, emphatic, outgoing, but it is clear he harbors deep scars from his childhood as the brother of one of the original cases. They are different scars than Peter Muncy's, because his experience is at the other end of the spectrum. His brother was much more difficult to manage, much more physically ill, and was at home for a much longer period of Jay's childhood, from when Jay was 10 or 11, till he was 16. It took a toll on his family that he remembers vividly. Lee had drop seizures as often as several times a day, and Jay got used to the sound of him falling to the floor in the next room. His father emotionally withdrew from the family, and his mother was overwhelmed. Autism had decimated the emotional functioning of a previously healthy family, the kind of dynamic that perversely came to be seen as further confirmation of parental responsibility. Lee had been institutionalized, but when he was about 6, his parents dropped by the facility and found the guard drunk and passed out. They brought Lee home. He had seizures. He had the worst epilepsy. As he got older, his seizures got much worse. The parents reluctantly looked for another residential setting and finally found it in a group home setting in Connecticut, where the residents lived in cabins and were called campers. It was clear Jay thought that had taken far too long. My mother was very ambivalent about placing him. She had difficult times when he came home, keeping him as long as possible. We had to basically carry him out. "Yes, you can have high-functioning autism," he said, but that was not his family's experience. Nobody had any idea how to manage it. They had no drugs to manage it at the time. They couldn't manage it with behavior. I don't think it's changed a hell of a lot. That's my feeling. Unlike Peter Muncy, who did not see a connection with mercury as a plausible factor in his sibling's case, Rosenberg did. In fact, after we outlined our research to him, he suggested developing a poster presentation for the American Academy of Neurology, of which he is a member. Rosenberg believes autism is multifactorial. He is convinced his brother's case had a strong genetic component because of the epilepsy and the fact he was different from birth, a failure to thrive baby. And although he believes the mercury association in the first cases is intriguing as a possible factor, he does not believe thimerosal from vaccines is a factor in the huge rise in autism diagnoses since 1990. David Newcomb Speck, Alfred L. Case 8. He was again seen in June 1941. His parents had decided to live together. Prior to that, he had been in 11 different schools. He had been kept in bed often because of colds, bronchitis, chickenpox, impetigo, and a vaguely described condition that the mother insisted was rheumatoid fever. This ended the clinic's contact with Alfred. The mother started him out on a tour of schools and hospitals, not informing them about preceding evaluations and taking him out after a time, not disclosing the next step she planned to take. We do know that he was at the V.V. Anderson School in Stratsburg-on-Hudson, New York, 1948 to 1950. The Taylor Manor in Ellicott City, Maryland, July to October 1954, and the Philadelphia Hospital Department for Mental and Nervous Diseases, March 3rd to April 20th, 1955. Sometime between the last two, he was for a time on Thorazine, then at a school for brain-damaged children founded by his mother in October 1954. Alfred is now 38 years old. So far as can be determined, he is at his mother's school. Both at Shepherd Pratt and Philadelphia hospitals, he was interested in the occupational therapy materials and did well with them. When this was brought to the mother's attention, she decided to take him out. Miriam Partridge Speck's on-again, off-again relationship with her husband, John, the chemist attorney at the patent office in Washington, ended permanently when they divorced in 1966. Their marriage had been volatile since she moved out with their newborn, David, and back to her parents' house in Baltimore in the summer of 1932. Her father, George Partridge, was a psychologist who got his Ph.D. and taught at Clark University, the site of Freud's famous American lectures in 1909. He was at Worcester, Massachusetts at the time. Perhaps he was sitting not far from Adolf Meyer to listen to the great man speak. In Baltimore, George Partridge was the director of classification and clinical service for the State Department of Prisons. Miriam's mother, Emmeline Newcomb Partridge, was a psychologist as well, and the year before David was born, had written a year-long series for the Boston Globe on preschool child testing methods. Given this milieu, it's not surprising that Miriam began taking psychology classes at Johns Hopkins after returning to Baltimore. There was clearly tension between Leo Kanner and Miriam Partridge. A clinical psychologist, very obsessive and excitable, was the only parent in the Capital Clinic's experience who did not allow notes to be taken when she gave the history. She pursued her own approach, opening a school for brain-injured children. In the early days, she was successful, receiving federal grants and positive newspaper articles. In one, a Brazilian father marveled that, after a year, his retarded child, whom he had come to take home, was able to greet him in words. But controversy appeared to follow her. There were disputes over the startup of two new branches of the school. She moved to Arizona and started the Partridge Memorial Treatment Center of Arizona in Tucson. The next year, she was ignoring health department closure threats. The school was raided in 1972, and she faced 11 criminal charges that were ultimately dropped. More suits followed, and in 1972, she gave a sad interview to the local paper in which she said, "I'm old. I'm flattened out." But between the lines, it's possible to see another image of Miriam Partridge. At a time when parents were blamed for autism, by Leo Kanner, among others, and it was widely considered a hopeless diagnosis, she was looking for occupational treatments for her son, moving him from institution to institution in an urgent, if impatient and imperfect, search for better treatments. In that sense, she became the first warrior mother, a phrase used in the autism treatment community to describe mothers who refuse to accept autism as a lifelong diagnosis or to stick to prescribed behavior treatments, but aggressively adopt biomedical approaches, take on the medical establishment over what many of them believe to be vaccine injury, and campaign for insurance coverage and treatment programs for all affected families. Like warrior mothers to come, she was also right about the cause of David's disorder. Brain damage, not bad parenting or bad genes. At a time when her doctor, Leo Kanner, and the rest of the medical community were most emphatically wrong. David Speck died in 2000, age 68, in Tucson. Richard M., Case 3. The mother felt that she was no longer capable of handling him, and he was placed in a foster home with a woman who had shown a remarkable talent for dealing with difficult children. After two changes of foster homes, he was placed at a state school for exceptional children in his home state in May 1946. A report dated June 23, 1954, said the institution accepted him as essentially a custodial problem. Therefore, he was placed with a group of similar charges. Richard is now 33 years old. In 1965, he was transferred to another institution in the same state. The superintendent wrote on September 29, 1970, "At the time of admission, tranquilizers were pushed to the point of toxicity. After about 3 months, he showed some awareness of his environment and began feeding himself and going to the toilet. He is now being maintained on Compazine, 45 milligrams TID. He now resides in a cottage for older residents who can meet their own personal needs. He responds to his name and to simple commands, and there is some nonverbal communication with the cottage staff. He continues to be withdrawn and cannot be involved in any structured activities. Although we determined his identity as a son of William Dykstra and Catherine Ritchie Miller, we were unable to find Richard M. and could not determine whether he is still alive." Leo Kanner wrote there were two good outcomes in the first 11 cases. Oddly enough, the first two, Frederick W. and Donald T. Frederick Creighton Wellman III, Frederick W., Case 2. Creighton had been placed in an institution in 1943, but he came to live with his parents just before his father retired from the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Puerto Rico in 1962 to become a visiting professor at North Carolina State. We settled into a new home, and Frederick did his part in it. The Wellmans, wrote Kanner. He has become acquainted with the neighbors and sometimes makes calls on them. We tried him out in the county sheltered workshop and vocational training center. He took right to it, made friends with the teachers, and helped with some of the trainees. Through his relationship there, he took up bowling, and he does pretty well. Kanner's 1971 follow-up concluded, "In 1969, Frederick W. began working at the National Air Pollution Administration, now part of the Environmental Protection Agency, doing routine tasks like running a copy machine. His boss wrote in 1970 that he is an outstanding employee by any standard." One person who knew the Wellmans in Raleigh was Robert Acock, the chairman of the plant pathology department, whom we quoted earlier on the rise of mercury fungicides in the 1930s. Fred's main interest in coming to the plant pathology department at Raleigh was to summarize his harvest years in the form of books, seminars, and interactions with faculty and students. Acock told us, "He was well known by most of the Latin American graduate students and was highly thought of, not only professionally, but personally as well. Dr. Wellman had had numerous contacts in Latin America with plant pathologists who sent graduate students to North Carolina State. My wife became acquainted with the Wellmans, and we were also invited on numerous occasions into their home, which was not too far from ours. Dora was noted for being a gracious host and set a dinner table without compare, all the finest cutlery, dishes, napery, etc., far beyond what casual friends might expect. I commented once to Dora that she need not go to all that trouble for us, and she replied somewhat like this, that since eating was often a chore, the least she could do was something to make the surroundings attractive. No mention of Creighton's problems and his behavior during his early years was ever noted. Their attitude portrayed a calm acceptance of reality, but also a deep love and attachment to him. They showed no embarrassment or frustration with Creighton's problems, although they would occasionally reflect with affectionate amusement on certain situations in which Creighton had been involved. The fact that Fred and Dora were devoted to each other was also quite apparent. A mutual friend remembered that it was not unusual to see Fred and Dora walk into a public gathering holding hands. Creighton was an unusual fellow, no doubt about it. Our home was a mile or two beyond the Wellmans, and on my way home from work or shopping at nearby Ridgewood Shopping Center, I often passed Creighton walking. Sometimes he would accept a ride, and sometimes not. If he accepted, he would usually begin immediately a conversation about some musical concert or performance that was to be held soon in Raleigh or at Duke or some other nearby place. He attended the nearby Methodist Church on Ridge Road and was enraptured by the music. And his interaction there caught the eye of several members who have looked after him to some extent to this day. It was obvious that Creighton enjoyed the company of the wives in the department more than the men. My wife was a favorite, and so were other wives in the department. Fred once remarked that, at Christmas, Creighton would present a most attractive and somewhat costly present to Dora, with a much more modest gift for him. In their late years, the Wellmans sold their attractive home and moved into a retirement complex. I don't really recall how long they were there, but I do remember that Fred called me sometime after Dora's death in desperation, wanting to know what he could do to provide for Creighton, after Fred was gone. Fortunately, friends in the church and at the complex were able to work with Fred and a relative, I believe, so that care for Creighton's future was assured. In 2006, we dialed the number listed on the apartment building intercom for Creighton Wellman. The man who answered said it was the wrong number. We tried one more time, dialing carefully, and got the same man and the same answer. We followed up with a letter that received no response. Donald Triplett, Donald T. Case 1. In 1942, his parents placed him on a tenant farm about 10 miles from their home. When I visited there in May 1945, Canner wrote in 1971, I was amazed at the wisdom of the couple who took care of him. They managed to give him goals for his stereotypes. They made him use his preoccupation with measurements by having him dig a well and report on its depth. When he kept collecting dead birds and bugs, they gave him a spot for a graveyard and had him put up markers. On each, he wrote a first name, the type of animal as a middle name, and the farmer's last name. For example, John Snail Lewis. Born, date unknown. Died, date on which he found the animal. when he kept counting rows of corn over and over, they had him count the rows while plowing them. On my visit, he plowed 6 long rows. It was remarkable how well he handled the horse and plow, and turned the horse around. It was obvious that Mr. and Mrs. Lewis were very fond of him, and just as obvious that they were gently firm. He attended a country school where his peculiarities were accepted, and where he made good scholastic progress. The rest of the story is contained in a letter from the mother, dated April 6, 1970. Don is now 36 years old, a bachelor living at home with us. Since receiving his A.B. degree in 1958, he has worked in the local bank as a teller. He is satisfied to remain a teller, having no real desire for promotion. Other interests are Kiwanis Club, served as president one term, J.C.'s, Investment Club, secretary of Presbyterian Sunday School. He is dependable, accurate, shows originality in editing the J.C. program information, is even-tempered, but has a mind of his own. He owns his second car, likes his independence. His room includes his own TV, record player, and many books. In college, his major was French, and he showed a particular aptitude for languages. Don is a fair bridge player, but never initiates a game. Lack of initiative seems to be his most serious drawback. He takes very little part in social conversation and shows no interest in the opposite sex. While Don is not completely normal, he has taken his place in society very well. So much better than we ever hoped for. If he can maintain status quo, I think he has adjusted sufficiently to take care of himself. For this much progress, we are truly grateful. Please give Dr. Kanner our kindest regards. Tell him the couple Don lived with for 4 years, Mr. and Mrs. Lewis, are still our friends. We see them quite often. Don has never had any medication for his emotional trouble. I wish I knew what his inner feelings really are. As long as he continues as he is now, we can continue to be thankful. We are sitting at the kitchen table of a comfortable home in Forest, Mississippi, talking to Don Triplett. This is the house his parents built in 1930, and except for the 11 months at the T.B. Preventorium, living on the farm with the Lewises in his early teens and attending college, this has been his home since he was born in 1933. Retired now at 76, he is wearing a Forest Presbyterian Church T-shirt, shorts, and sneakers. When one of us visited Forest 4 years earlier, he was out of town in Branson, Missouri, listening to country music. That was when we met his brother, who described his remarkable recovery after gold salts treatment for juvenile rheumatoid arthritis and said he had become a world traveler, recently touring Italy. Constantinople was his favorite city. Now, at the kitchen table, Don Triplett tells us he has since been to Dubai to watch a golf tournament and follow Ernie Els, his favorite pro. This is the first person diagnosed with autism? This is the sentinel case that alerted Leo Kanner to a devastating new disorder, unmistakable from early infancy, and which now is thought to affect 1 in 100 children? Talking to him does nothing to diminish our amazement. His only distinctive speech pattern is a stutter when he begins to talk. He has the sharp memory Kanner described. I went to Baltimore 3 times, he recalls. We rode on the train all 3 times. He remembers Leo Kanner very well, along with a female psychiatrist. I wrote, "What do you put on your lips?" And she put down nail polish. I'm sure she was kidding. And I wrote, "How much do you put on there?" and she wrote 1 quart. We begin asking questions, and his answers are direct and succinct. Question. When your parents decided to take you there, Baltimore, do you remember why that happened and what the motivation was? Answer. I was just sort of different from most of the people, and she thought she would take me up there. I really don't know how she got Dr. Kanner's name. I think both my parents went. Question. In Kanner's writing, he talks about your childhood and your background. He talks about the Presbyterian Church and some of the things that were a little different about you when you were a child. Do you remember the 23rd Psalm and the 25 questions and answers of the Presbyterian Catechism? Answer. Yes, I did memorize the Child's Catechism, and I did know the 23rd Psalm, and also the 100th. Question. Do you remember the Catechism? Answer. Who made you? God made you. What else did God make? God made all things. Why did God make you and all things? For His own glory. And so forth. Question. Do you remember anything about your physical health when you were a child? They said that you had some feeding difficulties. Answer. I did. I was a bit underweight. When I was 4 years old, I don't think I weighed over 30 pounds. Question. Another thing Leo Kanner mentioned was that you had arthritis as a child. How old were you then? Answer. Going on 14. It was called rheumatoid arthritis. Dr. Hamilton was the one who gave me the gold salts at the Campbell Clinic in Memphis. Question. How did that feel? Answer. That got me well after about 7 or 8 months, but then I had another attack in 1950 and another in 1959. All in February. All 3 times. But I didn't have to be hospitalized for that. Question. And that was it? You haven't had any problems since? Answer. I've been feeling some joint pains, but not anything like what I had when I was a child. Question. There was a mention in some of the medical papers that when you had the gold salts therapy, all of a sudden, some of the behaviors and some of the other problems got better. Do you remember that? Answer. No, I don't really remember that. Question. Did your parents say, though, that you seemed to get a lot better in terms of your relationship with the rest of the world, and that sort of thing at that point? Answer. Yes. As I got older, things got a whole lot better. Question. And did they think that had something to do with it, those gold salts treatments? Answer. I have a feeling it might. Question. And the behaviors they were calling autistic, did those change most after the first one? Answer. Yes, it seems like they changed. Question. But you don't remember that kind of change taking place? Answer. No, I don't remember, really. He is not the best witness to his own recovery, of course. His parents were. That is obviously the filter through which his brother, who was 6 years younger and would not have clearly recalled the sequence of events himself, described the gold salts treatment that had a miraculous effect on his autism. Like so many clues in the original cases, this observation by the mother and father of the very first case was almost lost to history, ignored by the experts. But it survived as an unsought treasure in the memory of a younger brother. How is that for serendipity? Don Triplett takes us on a tour of his house. That is the chair where his father sat and listened to phonograph records. This is the porch where he plays his own albums, entertaining neighborhood children, Favorites include Glen Campbell and Frank Sinatra. There, on the mantel, is an award from the Salvation Army. I gave them a lot of money, he says matter-of-factly. And everywhere there are family photographs, signs of affective contact with people, both present and long gone. Beeman and Mary, the parents of whom Canner was so suspicious, cousins and aunts, and his brother and nephew, Don as an infant, at 2, in high school. It is impossible to tell from the pictures, just as it is difficult at this meeting, that he was ever different from most of the people, much less markedly and uniquely so, in Leo Canner's phrase. To an attentive observer, there are traces, the stutter, a lack of eye contact, little discussion of emotions, the fact he never married. But it is a far cry from inhabiting a universe of one. We have come full circle on our journey into the history of autism, starting with Leo Canner in Baltimore and ending here, in a small town in Mississippi, a reversed loop of the trip that brought autism to the medical world's attention. But in a sense, we were following in Leo Canner's footsteps. His 1945 visit to Forest, 7 years after Donald T. visited the clinic, and just 2 years after Autistic Disturbances was published, shows how important Canner considered this sentinel case. Besides that visit and Canner's 1971 follow-up, though, interaction has been minimal. Triplett told us that he has had no direct contact with Hopkins since he saw Leo Canner 65 years ago. His brother says Hopkins checks in every decade or so. It's not as though his identity is a dark or forgotten secret. When Canner wrote in 1979 about encountering Donald T. for the first time, he said he was from Forest, Mississippi, and that townspeople know him to be the first reported specimen of what many of my colleagues call the Canner syndrome. Triplett and his brother told us that a film crew from France showed up a few years ago and filmed him playing golf, and that a public television outlet in the Washington area has been in touch. This lack of medical follow-up on Case 1 is symptomatic of a wider failure to investigate the natural history of autism, even as it looms ever larger as the defining disorder of our time. Autism is currently, in our view, the most important and the fastest evolving disorder in all of medical science, and promises to remain so for the foreseeable future, says Dr. Jeffrey A. Lieberman, chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at Columbia University's School of Medicine. Some, if not all, of the original case records appear to have been lost. After we contacted Jay Rosenberg, he asked Hopkins for copies of anything on file for his brother, Lee, John F. But a thorough search turned up only a single mention that he had been seen. In the 1980s, a National Institutes of Health researcher who wanted to conduct brain scans on autistic adults contacted Canner in search of early cases. The discoverer of autism was dying of cancer, but told her how to contact a Hopkins social worker who had the case files in her attic. The NIH researchers' subsequent studies did not include any of these original 11 autistic cases. Canner donated his papers to the American Psychiatric Association in Arlington, Virginia. But they contain no case files and precious little about autism at all. His biographical archive at Hopkins is meager, a collection mostly of newspaper clippings and speeches. The monographic presentation of the original case studies that he said he hoped to do remained unwritten. Kanner's own unpublished autobiography contains 5 cursory pages on autism. We read them when we visited Kanner's son, Albert, in Madison, Wisconsin. The Johns Hopkins Medical Archive says it misplaced its copy of his autobiography in a recent move. If the medical industry had been determined to obliterate the paper trail and ignore the insights available from those early cases, it could not have done a better job. But that is nothing new. On this journey, we have come to see the wisdom of Josef Warkany's observation in describing doctors' long failure to realize that pink disease was mercury poisoning, that medicine can go forward and yet go in circles. Doctors and scientists have learned far too little from 5 centuries of misdiagnosed mercury poisoning in medicine, from the rising tide of pollution and its toxic effects on the most vulnerable among us, from the unsought revelations contained in the early cases of autism, and from the astonishing improvement of case 1 after being treated for a medical condition. This long nightmare of neglect and delay and denial needs to end. And our visit with Don Triplett offered a hopeful glimpse of what that day might look like. In a few minutes, he told us as we took our leave, "I'm fixing to go out and play 9 holes of golf." Appendix. Notes on the Tuskegee Studies. First Phase. The initial survey was not strictly a prospective study. It was an in-depth population prevalence survey aimed at assessing morbidity in untreated syphilis cases. Vondelier et al., 1936, found no GPI in the untreated study population at all, and no evidence of any cases in the larger syphilitic population in Macon County from which the study group was drawn. Over time, the untreated group sought treatment on their own, and by 1948, 71.8% of the infected population examined had received treatment of some kind, mostly inadequate. So as the first phase came to an end around 1950, with the majority receiving pre-penicillin-era treatments in the 1930s and 1940s, the concept of a study of untreated syphilis in the American Negro had largely vanished. In each examination, the investigators were intensely interested in uncovering evidence of adverse neurological results in the syphilis group, and according to all the evidence, having syphilis was never a more healthy condition than not having syphilis. Still, the initial survey specifically pointed to the absence of GPI, and neither of the next 2 survey examinations reported any evidence of GPI, despite reporting on pathological conditions of the nervous system and psychosis. Even in the 4th survey, the 1952 autopsy study that examined one brain of a paretic, one case whose death was attributed to paresis, and one case who died of other causes and exhibited paretic symptoms, the authors commented that the great scarcity of frank syphilitic involvement of the central nervous system and the complete absence of lesser lesions attributable to syphilis are noteworthy. Second Phase. By 1950, it had become clear that penicillin was a complete cure for syphilis. Here, the investigators faced a real moral choice. Would they offer the study group penicillin or not? They chose not to offer penicillin in the infected men and intensified their study. They redoubled their effort to find patients lost to follow-up. They lumped all infected patients regardless of treatment status, back together in a single group, now defined as inadequately treated. They intensified their publication efforts, writing 6 separate papers around the 1952 survey. By 1952, as the frequency of inadequate treatment had risen, paretic patients were reported for the first time. By 1962, it was clear that mercury injections were common in the cases treated in the 1930s. As many as 4 GPI cases were reported in the infected group, about 1% of the overall study population. 3 cases, treatment status unknown, were reported in the autopsy study. 1 was confirmed by brain examination at autopsy. 1 was in the autopsy group, but without brain exam, and the cause of death was given as GPI. 1 died of other causes, but had symptoms of paresis. 1 was reported in the group of living patients examined in 1952, and was a patient that had received inadequate treatment. This has been an Audible, Inc. production of The Age of Autism, Mercury, Medicine, and as Man-Made Epidemic, written by Dan Olmsted and Mark Blacksill, narrated by Paul Bamer, producer Mike Charzik. Copyright 2010 by Dan Olmsted and Mark Blacksill. Production copyright 2013 by Audible, Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.